Okay. So thank you, Mr. Speaker, honorable panel, everybody who's watching for coming here, especially Shamik for being a phenomenal partner, new love of my life, guys inside opposition, very good debaters. I think we're going to have a phenomenal round. So the case that Shamik and I want to run, I think, is about something that's incredibly important in U.S. policy, something that we care a great deal about. The case is as follows. In the United States, state laws that require welfare applicants to undergo drug testing are bad and should not exist. So the only thing that we're going to throw in here in addition is that the proposed version of this in Ohio, which is just one example of it, has those who test positive getting referred to rehabilitation and able to reapply again in 6 months. It's pretty common. Sometimes if you're caught for a second time or a third time, you might be excluded entirely. Other things that happen here. So obviously you don't get your welfare payments. You're referred to rehabilitation. You're not forced to go. Any questions?
Yeah, so in the past when you've run this case, you allow teams to model what they want to defend. Is that still true?
Sure.
Sorry, just kidding. That was ridiculous.
Obviously within reason, like, so it has to follow the spirit of the law, but like if you want to defend certain kinds of drugs or you want to defend only cash payments, whatever you want, like in terms of like still having it within the framework of the law.
Are the rehabilitation programs they're referred to paid for?
So some rehabilitation programs are paid for. They typically have a lot of competition to get into them, and then there are other ones that you have to pay into.
I recognize it's not a policy debate, so before you guys get your counter cases ready, we're talking about a normative question of whether they're good.
The statement is these laws are bad.
And we're talking about...
If you guys want to counter case to something that's not mutually exclusive, go ahead, but like...
Wait, you're saying normatively this policy is bad.
Yeah.
So
the times you've run this case in the past, you've allowed teams to model. That's fine, right?
Yeah.
Allowed to model. Okay.
Yes.
So we will model something.
Okay. And if it's against the spirit of the law, which I clearly showed you can't do, then we'll call that out.
It will clearly be in the spirit of
that's fine
people.
With me.
So our model is David and Andrew win.
So you're against requiring drug testing as a prerequisite, correct?
Yeah.
Define prerequisite.
I don't really have any questions.
Okay, so do we model now or do we model later?
Yeah, you can do it on top of LOR.
LOR.
Oh, wow! Oh, you guys better watch out.
You guys good? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Shamik and I have three arguments that are going to be very compelling no matter what they come up with. So the first thing we want to talk about is how these policies are unconstitutional. And so, first of all, why is this important? Well, for a couple reasons. First of all, the Constitution obviously restricts what policies can and can't exist from a legal perspective. Secondly, though, it embodies sort of the spirit of American law and the very foundational principles that our country is based on. So when you violate those principles, you violate the very fundamental notion of what America is all about. So obviously you don't want to be unconstitutional. So why is it unconstitutional? We think it constitutes unreasonable search and seizure. Why is this? Blanket drug testing of poor people, based on the ever so persuasive reasoning that they probably use drugs because they're poor, is not reasonable. Police cannot simply search people's homes without a warrant, which can only be acquired if there's probable cause. But we would tell you, people's bodies are actually more intimately private to them than their homes are. So the amount of evidence that should be necessary to engage in this invasive search of someone's body chemistry should be more and not less than the case of searching someone's home or car, and it certainly shouldn't just be an offensive stereotype. So clearly, for the individual cases, you can't say that every individual who uses this has a reasonable ground for a search. So then what is the standard for when this right can be more generally violated, since they obviously can't meet that clause? So we would argue that the only instance in which these rights can be violated is when there's an imminent existential threat to other people, to sort of third parties. So for instance, drug testing policemen who carry guns, drug testing pilots, these kind of policies are acceptable because of the existential threat that those individuals would pose if they were on drugs in their professional capacity. But when we ask whether this case meets the standard, I think the answer is a clear and present no. Because first of all, realize that what OPP has to show is an imminent societal threat that is specific to welfare recipients who use drugs receiving their welfare money. Not just that these people are a danger generally, but the receipt of this money is actually something that's likely to like pose this existential threat. The closest that they might be able to get is something about the sort of crime that comes with from drug addiction. But these harms are simply exacerbated, not solved, if people are denied welfare money and have to turn to other means like crime, like prostitution, like loan sharks, things like that, to feed their addiction. We think those things have worse externalities for society than simple drug use in and of itself. So we would tell you that the only reason that you could use the fact that there's a societal threat from drug addicts to instate this policy is if the policy then solved that threat. Insofar as the policy doesn't solve that threat, which there are arguments that we'll show you, and actually makes it considerably worse when people get more desperate and have to turn to other means to finance this habit, we think that that's considerably worse, and that's something that's actually not solving the problem, but making it worse generally. The second argument that we want to talk about is why this policy is necessarily discriminatory. So first of all, we would say that it's generally oppressive, and that good governance is rule which is free from oppressive practices. Laws like this one constitute oppression because they marginalize those who are dependent on the government for material welfare, stripping them of equal citizenship rights. We think the premise of a policy is not just to instate some conditions under which people can act, but rather that policy actually sends a message to society about the underlying assumptions that are within that policy, and society like sort of sees the government giving cues about what is true. So we think when the government basically says poor people use drugs, that feeds into a stereotype which is extremely negative and which marginalizes people in society who don't deserve any worse conditions than the ones they're currently living in. So governments have a positive duty to provide the minimal constraints of material welfare for individuals who are disadvantaged by structural constraints. We would tell you that welfare is not charity, it is not a gift, it is an obligation that governments incur upon themselves when they sort of solidify the property rights that will allow wealthy people to hoard all of their property and not share it with individuals who actually need it to survive. So the idea that because these people depend on their government, their privacy is somehow less important than the privacy of others is obviously and clearly discriminatory. Drug use in all of its forms in society poses some potential harm, but policies like this one send the message that the poor are in some special position in which they're uniquely unable to manage their own lives, and that the government needs to look out for them, to check up on how they're doing, to micromanage their lives because they can't do it themselves. We think that sends the wrong message to these poor people and the wrong message to society more generally. Look. Farmers receive government subsidies, so do businesses, so do Medicare recipients. Those people don't get drug tested because they aren't poor. The message is that the well-off can manage their own lives while the poor need to be micromanaged.
Here, here.
So what are the harms of this other than the fact that it obviously just makes people's lives worse? So first of all, it's demeaning. These people have to be subjected to these tests. They have to functionally be told by the government through this policy that they're somehow suspicious, that even though the vast majority of welfare applicants aren't on drugs, these people are somehow really likely to be using them and have to be tested for it. This contributes to the gaping disconnect between the impoverished and the government, makes the poor seem more marginalized and less empowered to improve their conditions. Further, this lends credence to the hateful views of taxpayers who think that poor people are just lazy drug addicts who steal the money of these hardworking taxpayers. This optically puts the government on the side of those people. It creates added societal tensions. It puts the taxpayers and the poor into conflict by painting them as opposed forces, and then instead of ruling without bias, it actually picks a side in that kind of conflict. The final thing under this second argument, though, is that when you create a disconnect between the government and these poor individuals and then suggest to them to go to government-sponsored rehabilitation after telling them that you are suspicious of them and basically telling them that they somehow have to use drugs because they're poor, I think they are less likely to go to these government rehab programs because they do not trust the government, because the government has shown that they do not trust them. The last argument that we want to make is about societal harms. Firstly, this is worse for potential welfare recipients. It excludes those who test positive for months. But those people who just quit, perhaps they even go to the welfare program, to the rehabilitation program, still need the money. They still have to survive. They still have to eat food and provide winter coats for their children. People who are on drugs also are harmed by this. They still need money, again, for the basics of life, even if they are on drugs. They might have children who need this money as well. Even if some of the welfare money goes to drugs, no thanks, they might use some to feed their kids, and that possibility isn't there inside opposition. In addition, these people aren't just going to stop using drugs because they don't receive their welfare, because that's not how addiction works. It is a physiological condition which compels you to use the drugs anyway. They are more likely to turn to crime, to loan sharks, to prostitution, to gangs, to finance their habit. This is worse for their families, worse for them, and worse for society. So the very last thing we want to note is that this is actually worse for taxpayers, the very people who we think should be motivated, who like potentially are motivating this policy. So look. The cost of these tests themselves come out of the taxpayers' pockets. Almost nobody tests positive. Yeah. Also, given the last argument about turning to crime, ultimately taxpayers have to pay more to keep people in jail than they would have had to pay for their welfare. Also, the very motivation of this policy is entirely backwards because it creates more societal harms that cost money when these people aren't able to sort of get their money in the first place and have to turn to bad means to do so. We think that denying welfare money that occasionally allows people the stability to get a job and to make it out of poverty just entrenches the cyclical nature of poverty. That is, when children have parents without money, they can be pressured to drop out of school. They might turn to drugs themselves to run away from their problems. Then the system gets screwed over because you've perpetuated the cycle of poverty, and because this is more welfare money than being spent, more prison money being spent in the long term, and the persistence of the problem of poverty, whereas we think comparatively you can at least alleviate some of those harms on our side of the house. We are incredibly proud to propose.
Thank you very much. Call up the leader of the opposition to respond, not to exceed 8 minutes, please.
Here, here.
Thanks, everybody. Really happy to be here. Surprise, surprise, we're going to countercase. So what we're going to advocate today is that we should be able to exclude people based on drug use in housing voucher programs funded by the government for the use of illegal drugs other than marijuana. So we think this is a preferable policy for four reasons. The first is that we think that housing is unique and that housing is not an absolute right. We think that it's pretty clear that this is the way the government policy generally treats housing, and that's not being changed by government in this round. We condition it on a whole host of other prerequisites, things like searching for a job, where we put people in homeless shelters, alternative ways to avoid being on the streets. Given that we still condition housing on pursuing things like having a job or not causing a disruption or major disruption within the home, we think that's going to be sufficient reason to think that housing is not some sort of absolute right. It's especially not an absolute right given the existence of other ways to make sure that there's a roof over someone's head or they're not exposed to complete dangers of the street, things I mentioned before like temporary homeless shelters or transitional housing. That means that we're not throwing people on the street, so minimally there's no absolute right to having the nicest housing possible, even if there's a right to at least have a roof over your head. The second argument is about a limited supply. So what we tell you is that there's a finite amount of funds that can be spent on providing people with housing vouchers and getting people to have a roof over their heads. But that means that when we provide a housing voucher to an individual, it's a one-to-one trade-off with providing that housing voucher to someone else. So that means that even if you don't think that people are completely responsible for their choice to use drugs, we still have to be making some sort of comparison where we're evaluating who to give these limited vouchers out to. What we tell you is that when people are not using drugs, those people are more likely to be able to transition out of government housing in the long run because they're less racked by these massive problems of addiction, they're less likely to create disruptions within the housing units, less likely to bring crime into those housing units. We think we'd be prioritizing things like rehab or transitional housing for people using drugs, but given that we have to make some sort of determination about who to give a limited number of vouchers to, we think we should give it to the people who are going to be able to use this housing best, those individuals who are not using hard drugs. We have extremely few metrics to determine who we're going to be giving out limited vouchers to. Even if it's imperfect to use the use of hard drugs as this metric, it's better than just having a totally random assessment. If they're going to be able to combat this argument, they're going to need to give you some meaningful, substantial metric to arbitrate who should be getting limited housing vouchers that's going to function better than the use of hard drugs. Otherwise, we're certainly better than having an arbitrary assessment of who gets into these housing programs. So the third argument here is that, our program eliminates the stigma that's associated with voucher programs. So when people in the general political discourse know that assistance in housing is not going to drug abusers, it means that they're more likely to be providing increased funding to these sort of housing programs. That means that there's going to be more individuals who are getting a roof over their head because there's more funding since there's no longer an association with the undeserving poor, people who have done bad things going into these housing programs. It disempowers the argument that the people who are in government housing don't deserve to be there. That means that there's a likelihood of increased funding. We think even if we exclude some drug abusers, it's better to get more people with roofs over their head, but you disagree.
Doesn't making this policy specifically entrench the idea that these people have that poor people are people who are on drugs constantly?
No, because then when you test everybody and there's virtually no results that come up positive, it becomes extremely difficult to say all the poor people are using drugs. When you're not testing them, it allows for crazy conservatives to be like, they're all using drugs, we better test them. Once you start testing, that argument goes away, as per the last argument in their case. So the final argument we want to make is that there's probably at least some marginal effect on drug use, deterring people from using them, at least in some limited circumstances, even if oftentimes people are driven by addiction. We think this gives an extra impetus to try to get off of drugs without completely withdrawing all government support from these individuals. I'll talk a little bit more about the negative social externality of drug use on the government case. So let's go to the government case now. The first argument they make is about how blanket testing is morally wrong. But the problem is that you're not actually compelling people to submit to this testing. They're voluntarily submitting to the drug test in order to receive government benefits that the government is in no way constitutionally obligated to give them. For instance, we require people to submit to drug testings when they're applying for a federal job as well. The reason we allow that is because a person has voluntarily submitted their application. The same thing as helping in welfare, which means there's no unreasonable search because it's a voluntary submission to the search. For instance, when people are going through airport security, they have to submit to the search because they consented through the act of flying.
you disagree.
Does it say no unreasonable search or seizure unless the government is giving you some kind of benefit?
No, it's saying no unreasonable search and seizure. You are not compelled to be searched. You choose to apply for a program that in turn causes you to be searched. It's very different than the government saying, we'll lock you up and throw you in jail unless you allow us to search us right now. That's also like all Supreme Court precedent ever, which is why we're allowed to have things like drug testing for federal jobs. That's always been the precedent in the US. Next argument they make is that there's no social harms to drug use. So here's the problem. Even if they have welfare, it's still insufficient to pay for very for drugs. So that means that they're still going to have to engage in illegal actions, things like theft, in order to be able to afford those drugs. So what are the problems with this? First, I mean that it's a good thing to decrease drug use because it means that there's going to be a decrease in these sort of like external activities of using drugs. Moreover, some drugs are just uniquely and always harmful. For instance, if someone is like taking PCP, for instance, they're probably going to be like beating the shit out of someone because PCP is insane. But additionally, what they do is bring those crimes into new areas, into housing projects, and into like private housing that was formerly relatively free of the sort of hard drug use. The problem is that they don't do anything at the same time to actually reduce like drug sales that are going on the street just by moving some people out. You're still going to have gangs in those areas. So they have all the same crime that exists in the status quo out on the streets, but then they move that crime into additional new areas and create additional social harms. The next argument they make is that we send the message that poor people can't manage their lives. So I don't think that's true, for the same reason why I don't think we send a message that like people applying to federal jobs can't manage their lives when we make those people submit to drug tests as well. This isn't something that's unique to the poor. But what we also tell you is that like drugs are still illegal for everyone, and we still try to prosecute other people for drugs. That's sending the exact same message. But moreover, this argument also relies on the notion that it's actually forcibly causing poor people to submit to it. It's only if you're applying for government benefits. But also what we tell you is that there's going to be there's a greater likelihood when individuals are poor to have these negative externalities that are associated with drug use as compared to when individuals are wealthy, because they're more likely to have to resort to crime or other activities with negative social externalities in order to fund their drug habit, because they have less money to spend. So the next argument they make is that the poor are going to look marginalized, and it's going to be seen demeaning to the poor. So what we tell you is it's actually going to increase funding to welfare programs broadly, as I told you in the off case, because it disassociates the undeserving poor from welfare policies, which increases funding total, which we think is going to have a greater marginal benefit in putting like more people in housing than getting like a smaller number of people who are on drugs in housing. The next argument they make is that we exclude those who have just quit using drugs. But the problem is that we, A, still provide these individuals with other forms of welfare, like getting food stamps and assistance like that, and unemployment checks and things of that sort. And we can also provide things like temporary shelter or transitional housing so those people have a basic set of support, and then when they demonstrate sustained commitment to sobriety, get moved into long-term housing, they don't get screwed over. In terms of the argument about kids, what we tell you is that we still get these kids access to things like food and other resources. We also make it so that like these kids are eventually able to get housing when their parents are able to get off drugs, and we provide them with the means to help quit drugs. But also what we tell you is that the people who are not using drugs are also likely to have kids. If we care about kids, we want to be prioritizing the method that's going to be able to put houses in them for the most number of people, the ones where people are most likely to transition out of that housing in the long run and save the government money so they can house more people, the ones who are the least likely to have negative externalities and raise costs in those housing projects, the ones where there's the most likely of increasing funding to put roofs over people's heads in the long run. The last argument they make is really interesting, which is that virtually nobody ever tests positive. If that's true, virtually nobody ever gets excluded from the welfare programs, and there's zero negative impact whatsoever. The only impact they could get out of the government case is the claim that it's demeaning and demonizing to the poor. That is not the case at all. Our argument is that what allows this demonization of the poor is the fact that it's impossible to confirm whether poor people applying for welfare are taking drugs. What we do is disempower completely the argument that poor people who are receiving a government assistance are drug addicts and not deserving of help. If no one gets excluded, which they tell you is the case, none of the concrete harms the government discusses will ever happen. All that happens is that we completely eliminate the ability of the conservative right to make arguments that poor people are using drugs and don't deserve our help. We take that away, we help poor people out more, we increase funding without actually excluding anybody from these housing programs. For these reasons, we're proud to oppose.
Thank you very much. Call up the MG, respond. 8 minutes, please.
Thank you. You're here.
All right. That's almost certainly. All right, whatever. A lot of stuff was said in the last 8.5 minutes.
very quickly. But I think the important thing we need to recognize is, A, I'm not sure about how legitimate this countercase is, because I don't think it actually deals with the fundamental thrust of the philosophy we're asking, which is whether or not these policies are good or bad. It's not whether we can enact a policy. They have to actually tell you why they are good or bad on society, why they make relationships better with government or not. It's simply not enough to run what Kate Falkenstein fucked them over at Nats and try to win this round. But let's play ball, let's deal with what they're saying. First, I say housing is not an absolute right. So, firstly, we don't actually agree with this. What Goldberg v. Kelly tells us, what many state precedents tell us, is you do have legal obligations as a government to provide people with basic services. So now the question becomes, is housing important? So Andrew says something really funny, and I just have to bring it off of the on-case on here. He says, listen, guys, we can still give them welfare, we can still give them food stamps, we're just not going to give them a home. So there's a problem with that. Homes are incredibly important for everything else. That's why they're considered a facilitative right in all types of law legal discussions right now. Because a home is the way you actually get a job. Because guess what? You need an address to put down when you apply for one. A home is the way that you get a license because you need to put an address down there too. But when you have all the food stamps and you buy your rice, what are you going to warm it up in unless you have a kitchen? But Andrew didn't give you one. So a home is an incredibly facilitative right. So to win the round, it's not enough for them to just get up here and be like, dogs, we're going to give them a lot of other shit. They have to tell you why denying a home still maintains the basic respects for human dignity that we've heard throughout legal history is actually essential. So problems. So the second thing that we also hear, though, is listen, guys, it's conditional. And the important thing is it's that we have a finite supply of housing. So recognize that what we would tell you is what isn't also in talked about in their case is there are many other people who live in these homes who are hurt by this as well. So it's not as if just that person gets removed. And because they didn't even mention this around, there's kids in there. There's other people who need that housing. So why are their rights abdicated by one individual's choice? Why is their ability to all these different services completely ruined? Why are they forced into the cycle of poverty and the absolute abject horror of homelessness because of one individual? That's never warranted here. Andrew forgets about that. But the finite supply would apply to them as well. They deserve it in this scenario too. And they have to actually tell you why that works. But also recognizing this situation, what we're fundamentally telling you is not whether their policy is good. It is whether in sum total, the net benefit of drug testing for government services works or not. So that's a weighing mechanism, not simply an assertion you can make. So the next thing we hear is, listen, there's a stigma for vouching. And this is when I started laughing, I think you could audibly hear. And it's because I think what they're saying is politicians will say, look, there's no drugs here. So almost certainly, let's fund it to the wazoo. Because Newt Gingrich has just been looking for a reason to fund welfare in society. These people don't want to fund welfare. This is the political excuse they use. They have a whole lot of other ones to use. For example, the drug tests don't work, but you can't fucking tell if someone's using PCP if they didn't use it for one day and test it. They actually get out of your system in like something like 2 hours. So the entire argument won't work. Republicans will always find ways to try to drug test people and to assert that poor people are lazy. There's no mechanism by which they can actually show you, you get this increasing bonanza funding. But on case, I'm about to show you why you actually don't get it, and that's particularly problematic. What we also tells you, though, is no one does test positive. Now, Andrew thinks he's caught us here. You know, he's so excited, and he's like getting ready to jump on us. But the reason people don't test positive welfare policy is because they just don't show up to the test.
You're here.
That's why. It's because if I know I'm addicted, I'm not going to go to a government center where there's police and other people who are not in my interest and just go pee into a cup knowing what the result's going to be. So that's my problem with this scenario. So what do they instead do? They don't show up. But that's what David was telling you happens. When they don't show up, they cut themselves off from all of the state services now, including their kids' help, including the food stamps and all that. Then what do they turn to support each other? Not countercasing, they do crime. They do a lot of other crazy things. And I think the problem in that scenario is you have a society that actually makes people who need the help the most, you actually leave them in the cold the most. So this countercase is illegitimate, but it's also ridiculous. It doesn't deal with the thrust of the debate. But more importantly, it penalizes a lot of other people who aren't involved in the situation. It doesn't deal with the issue that housing is a facilitative right. And in order for anyone to ever get better through a welfare system that invests in individuals, you need to give them housing to a certain extent. But most importantly, it also ensures that you have more funding. What's up, Dave?
Have to choose a metric for how to exclude some individuals and include others, what would you advocate for?
Probably need. I think need's a good one. Look at who needs it the most and how poor they are, and that's probably a good way. So let's get on to the on case. First, we tell you it's unconstitutional. The only response we got here, this was interesting, they said, listen, there's no obligation to give it to them, and we do it for federal jobs, and oh, they consented. So let's deal with the consent argument first. This is the most fallacious. The notion that people are consenting to drug testing or welfare is ridiculous. Look at what the stakes are. Either I eat tonight, or I pee into this cup. Does that feel like a fair choice? So I have a thought experiment. Let me take a gun to each one of the judges' head and say, either you vote for me or I'll shoot. Do you think you're making a fair choice? I think it's the same scenario here. We're literally threatening life if they do not choose to take this activity. That is coercion at its most basic intent. It is forcing them towards one path without the actual agency to make that choice. And the entire reason that we have an entire search and seizure protection is that those type of initiatives aren't allowed by a government. So the question that we get, that Dave asks, which Andrew doesn't deal with, is a lot of social services exist, like roads. We don't allow police to just pull you over and open your trunk, even though that is a service that's provided by government. You are voluntarily driving on the road. Make them tell you why that's uniquely different in that perspective. But even if none of that matters, this is a constitutional question. What they need to tell you is fundamentally why you give up your right to privacy just because you're poor, because they're not doing it for every American. It is only for certain Americans who are under some type of economic classification. Undealt with. Interesting. The response we got, though, is we do it for a federal job. Now, I'll give them this. That is also coercive to a certain extent. But we have to weigh the amount of coercion being extended. One individual choosing a job voluntarily when he likely makes that choice knowing that he can do this versus one individual told you're going to starve if you don't make it. The coercion is much worse. But here's the kicker. We may not even be okay with federal drug testing either. We're happy to say that we wouldn't think drug testing is valid, but that's not right either. So that's not an offensive point that they actually went on. They tell you the airport issue. Go to the next one we talked about, externalities. The reason you may put people through a scanner at the airport is so they don't blow up the plane. The last time a heroin user blew up a house or something like that, I don't think that's really occurring here, and I simply don't think that would matter for just people on welfare. Don't even make a break of that reference. So the other thing we hear is something about, they tell you about discrimination. We tell you it's oppression that, you know, reflects societal standards and biases that we have. It entrenches this notion, these ideas that poor people aren't worth funding, and we tell you all these other things. So they say we give all these other benefits. I think our response is very clear. You can only use these benefits if you have housing. Housing is essential and completely important for anything else to actualize. We told you, listen, they give, you know, we can increase funding. I want to actually take a real problem with this point. Just recognize that this is absolute bullshit. And the reason it's bullshit is because this actually decreases funding. So in Andrew's world, they take everything he said. People are going to be weeded out by the drug test. And he said that's good, so more people get in. So where do these people go, though? So maybe they go on the street and commit crime. I think that's likely. Or maybe they go to the state next door, which has a really friendly welfare policy. And what if that happens in mass? So millions of individuals, hold on, Dave, it's getting there. Millions of people start moving to these other states that have benevolent welfare policies. This is called a race to a bottom. And what eventually occurs is the next state that just intook millions of people who now need welfare will start restricting its own welfare policy because it can't afford to do so. So what happens then? They come up with another bullshit plan like theirs, and people move to another state. And until the whole entire America has become a home state, everyone makes more restrictive welfare policies to try to get less people on their rolls. And what occurs is all together, welfare throughout this nation goes down. So they actually decrease funding in a very meaningful way. And I think that's particularly problematic. But the last thing they tell you is, listen, fundamentally there's an issue here that if you exist in society, no one tests positive. And I think the problem here is this. There's also a cost issue. They didn't deal with this at all. Recognize that it's impossible to figure out whether drugs are actually in the system for most drugs. They flush out very quickly. People can manipulate the system, so that advocacy goes away. But also recognize, if it is true what Andrew said, and he's trying to get either or here, if people don't test positive, and it shows Republicans that all people in welfare are clean, you've just wasted a ton of money to try to change a mind of someone who will never change mind. If a lot of people are using drug tests, they simply won't show up. Their addiction hasn't been cured, you can't force them to rehab, they can't afford it, they're on welfare. But more importantly now, they're on the street seeking jobs. They're either going to burden other state systems, or they themselves are going to turn to crime. In either world, it's not good. Remember, this is a question about whether it's good or bad, not whether Andrew could come up with a policy, which was pretty terrible either way. For all these reasons,
thank you very much. Call up the member of the opposition to respond. No minutes of notice.
Everyone's making fun of me already. I'm dumb. Can you make fun of me just like when I say dumb things?
Sure.
So thanks, everyone. So first on the framework of the counter case, so they tell us that we can model and that's perfectly fine. So it's not really like meeting the standard of proof of like counter cases. It's just like they told us model a program. We are doing that. I think one of the most important components of the model that Shomeek doesn't deal with is that we're explicitly only talking about instances where there are limited resources that can't go out to everyone. So what differentiates this from a road is that there are enough roads for everyone to go around, but in instances when there aren't enough housing vouchers for everyone to have one, we have to choose a metric by which we differentiate differentiate who does and does not get those vouchers. This is something that Shomi doesn't deal with and is going to be damning for them in the round. So the first thing we say is housing is not a universal right, and they cite some like local state court case, which is A, pretty specky, and they're like, ah, it says basic services. So we're okay with saying that the state probably has an obligation to provide basic services. Things like shelters, things like rehab programs, things like halfway houses. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to extend all welfare programs to those individuals. In the case of voucher programs, when those are differentiated and given out to a very few number of individuals, we think it's okay to provide restrictions there if they still have their basic needs met out elsewhere. But there's just a basic problem here, right, that they're not dealing with. If you buy their argumentation, which tells you that like a housing voucher is a basic right, the number of people that are excluded don't go up on our side of the house. And in fact, we'll actually tell you that we capture more people with vouchers, extending that right to more individuals. Shomi needs to grapple with the reality in the United States, which is that some people are denied vouchers, which means that some people's rights on their argumentation is being dropped and not being fulfilled. There's no reason why we can't choose like whether or not you test positive to be one of the attributes that we actually care about. That's incredibly important. So we don't think you can say it is a universal right to have vouchers, and even if you do, we're not uniquely violating that right of any individual. The second thing that Andrew talks about is the limited number of vouchers. And Shomi's like, but guys, the kids! Think about the kids! Okay, so there are kids on both sides of the house? The number of housing vouchers for family of four is fixed within a community? The number of housing vouchers for families of five is also fixed. So what we say is, there are kids in both instances. We say you ought to differentiate towards those adults that aren't addicted to hard drugs. We are perfectly okay with this sort of metric. So, when I ask the POI, what metric do we use, right? I give Shomik a chance to save themselves out of dropping this argument. And Shomik says, oh, it's about the like baseline of how wealthy you are. So yes, that's the first prerequisite. You have to be poor to get a housing voucher, right? But they don't tell you what to do after you're poor. Because if there are like 10 housing vouchers and 20 poor families, then you have to figure out a way to choose which of those 20 families are going to get those housing vouchers. And what we would tell you is that choosing drug addiction is much better than the other metrics that sort of exist. So let's actually talk about the way this plays out in the real world. So what happens is oftentimes religious organizations or other nonprofits get capturing of those vouchers. So they get distributed from the federal government to the states, they get distributed through block grants to communities. And those communities choose the 501c3s that are actually able to distribute them. So in my community, who holds most of the housing vouchers? Catholic Outreach. This is really damning because it means that individuals who want access to housing vouchers are given preferential treatment based on things like their religion. Look, recognize there's always going to be discrimination. What connections you have within the 501c3 structures, who you're going to get access to. So we think that you're going to have to discriminate who gets limited resources from welfare on one side of the house or the other. We think that it's uniquely better to choose illegal activities with negative externalities as your metric for who ought to get preferential treatment from the government, rather than like whether or not you're religious, whether or not you have connections at a certain nonprofit. We think all of these things are better metrics. We also think that the reason that good, like addiction to hard drugs is also good is like these families or these individuals are least likely to transition. They're most likely to need those vouchers indefinitely, which means we actually get benefits when we put those that are more likely to transition that aren't addicted in these areas. Then we have the stigma argument. Okay, so he's like, look, conservatives will be angry all the time, but the point is this actually takes away the weight that conservatives have to convince moderates, right? When everyone getting a housing voucher has passed a drug test, it makes it much harder for people like Gingrich to actually convince them. So what does the dialogue change from? The problem with conservatives is that they're able to come out and say that the undeserving poor, those that are only poor because of addiction, are getting this funding. However, when you create a gateway and require people to pass drug tests, we greatly diminish this access that they have to this argumentation, because then it's only the deserving poor, those that aren't addicted, or at least the more deserving poor. Even if drug tests are imperfect, we still think that we greatly change the way in which the dialogue happens, which means that more people are willing to increase funding with things like housing vouchers. People are also much more likely to take them. Here's another really important thing about stigmas of vouchers. People are afraid to take vouchers if they know that the person that they're giving the voucher to is addicted on hard drugs. People just have these like negative feelings towards anyone that might be having hard drugs. So once, because the stigma exists in society that like all poor people are drug addicts, there then means that landowners don't take vouchers, which hurts all poor individuals who have those vouchers because it limits the number of people that are willing to take those vouchers, which hurts everyone. However, when you provide that screening process, it takes away that stigma. They can't actually require testing. It's illegal to require testing if you're a landowner, but the problem is when they see those vouchers, they can come up with other reasons for why you're not deserving, which excludes them from the pool, and it's really bad. You guys didn't take one during PMC. Come on. Okay. So the and it was going to be a foreshadow of the argument you draw. Come on. Okay. So the fourth argument Andrew gives you is this sort of like marginal effect, and the response we get is there's a self-selection process. Okay. Andrew's argument is that there's a deterrent effect on the number of people that are going to choose hard drugs. It is likely that one or two people aren't going to do drugs because they want to have that access to housing vouchers, whether or not it's for their kids or for their own well-being. The fact is there are just going to be less drug addicts on our side of the house, something Shomik never actually addresses when he talks about these sorts of arguments. Let's go on, Case. Sure.
So, if the whole thing is that states are going to allocate more money, after Florida's welfare drug testing system showed no one used it, why the next year did welfare's allocation for welfare, or Florida's allocation for welfare, go down?
Okay, so your race to the bottom argument's actually great here, because what you told us was that poor people are going to leave places like Florida because they have discriminatory policies. So they all flock to places like San Francisco. Why is this really good? San Francisco has the best homeless policy in the country and are able to transition people. So you move people from places like rural Colorado that have very few addictive services to help people quit addiction because they are incredibly conservative. You move them to liberal areas where they can actually get rehab and other programs. So not only do they go there for the vouchers, but they then accidentally get access to all these other services that transitions them off of welfare, which means they no longer need these voucher programs in the long run. So we drastically decrease the number of people that are dependent as like people move around to the areas with the best programs, which we actually think is a good thing. Also, just because like Florida's really bad doesn't mean that everywhere else is really bad. We think that's okay. So then they're like, look, it's really coercive with these like to eat or pee into a cup. So one, you still get to eat, right? Like we explicitly didn't choose starvation as the one that we're modeling. You still get access to homeless shelters. We also think it's pretty coercive in a job, right? If you spend 4 years in college, maybe grad school, maybe internships, trying to get a government job, and like your entire career is set up explicitly for that government job, or that job that requires a federal job, means that you've invested your entire life. So we think it's equally coercive in those instances. Already dealt with the roads argument. Already dealt with the fact that people are going to move away. So, oh, and they drop Andrew's argument, which tells you that negative externalities are worse for poor individuals. They never deal with this sort of argument. So then, like, okay, also, they have, like, this massive privacy argument. So I'm not really sure what privacy is so bad, right? And what, like, talk about demeaning. What's demeaning is that you walk around as someone with a housing voucher, or you live in public housing, or you take that voucher to get somewhere, and everyone thinks you're a drug addict. The benefit on our side of the house is, A, you remove all of that demeaning stigmatization because everyone knows that you aren't a drug addict. But also it's unclear what privacy violations actually occurring, given that everyone tests positive, as they say, or don't test positive on their side of the house, as they explicitly told you, which means none of these individuals are actually being harmed by having to explicitly pee in a cup. They need to do much more to show, like, why me peeing in a cup and handing it to someone is such a violation of my privacy, given that it's going to give us no information except I'm not doing drugs. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Call the LO. Close out the up lock. 4 minutes. You know the candidates.
Thanks, everyone. Really great round. So at the end of this debate, there's three issues I want to talk about. First, who houses the most people in need? Second, how each side affects welfare discourse? And then finally, I want to talk about government obligations. So let's look at housing the most number of people who need roofs over their head. So what we tell you is that there's a limited supply of housing vouchers, so you need some metric to determine who gets those vouchers and who doesn't. Government tells you that the metric should be who needs them the most. Great, we need an actual metric to determine need, because questioning who needs it just begs the question. We tell you that testing for drug use is a good, actual metric for determining how to best spend the money. We tell you that people who aren't using drugs are more likely to transition out of government housing in the long run or in the short run, which means that you're able to house more people and help more people get better lives in the long run, and the people who are using drugs are at least marginally more likely to bring crime into these housing areas that were formerly didn't have as much crime, create negative externalities, and new costs. So, we increase the total amount of housing we're able to provide by making more people transition out into long-term and dependent stability and by reducing costs. That means that we get more housing for people generally, people who aren't using drugs, and people who also have kids, right? The kids' arguments exist on both sides of this debate. If we get more housing for everyone who's poor, that's more housing for innocent kids and families as well. They been trying to make the argument that we're going to end up restricting who gets them, right? Which is going to reduce numbers. There's a big difference between restricting eligibility and reducing the number of vouchers. Even with restricted eligibility, you can still have the same number of vouchers or more of them. There's just some people who are excluded from them. What we tell you is that even with the restrictions, we're going to be increasing the total number of vouchers by meaning that more people transition out and that there's more money available to spend on them. But maybe they're right. The drug addicts are going to move elsewhere. So what we tell you is that even if they move elsewhere, there's still all that these states are going to implement is restrictions on eligibility, not reducing the total number. But moreover, even if they move elsewhere, places like San Francisco or Austin or Boston, like Massachusetts and California, are still going to be generous. Great. The other states have more money to spend on people in need, and these states are going to be generous and provide the empirically demonstrated best benefits and assistance to drug addicts to help them transition. We think all of that's wonderful. So we help people. Now let's talk about welfare discourse. So what we tell you is that we dramatically disempower anti-welfare arguments that are premised on the idea that people receiving welfare benefits like housing are the quote-unquote undeserving poor, people who are, for instance, drug addicts. What they tell you is that Newt Gingrich is a crazy asshole and is always going to oppose welfare policies. Probably true, right? But he still has to convince people and get a majority of people to share those same views. We say it becomes a lot more difficult to convince moderates that welfare policy is going to people who are drug addicts if you're testing the people who are receiving benefits and it's demonstrated that they're not on drugs. That makes an argument a hell of a lot less persuasive, which means it's easier to increase funding for welfare policy when it's viewed as going to the deserving poor. That means that we transition the discourse about welfare to view it as something that people deserve, that people ought to be getting. They're not going to drug addicts, which means that we increase overall funding, getting more people welfare services of a whole host of different types, including housing, and yes, welfare and housing for people who have kids and families too. So their only response to this is that, like, in the specific knowledge about, like, the Florida budget going down 1 year after they implemented this drug testing. So first, like, they should probably actually respond to the reasons we give in our argument for why it's likely to change this rhetoric rather than throwing out a random statistic about a budget. But additionally, we think that even if it didn't change the discourse in 1 year, like, probably it can change it in the long run, give credence to our arguments over a random piece of spec knowledge. Let's finally talk about government obligations. So what we tell you and what government doesn't engage with is the argument that even if people have a right to some basic shelter, they don't have the right to the best possible shelter, right? So we still provide people with access to things like transitional housing or homeless shelters. We just don't give people things like housing vouchers. So they never demonstrate why there's a right to the best type of housing coming out of these vouchers, which means that we're not coercive because we're not dangling people's ability to have a roof over their head. But even if we were actually like engaging in some sort of, even if their arguments get some credence for the unreasonable search and seizures, what we tell you is that courts are totally fine with, for instance, testing people for federal jobs, which is still coercive in the same way. If you're applying for a federal job, that's the way that you're going to get your income, especially because like people who are poor also apply for federal jobs and have to get these testings. Courts are consistently okay with this, meaning it's not unconstitutional, right? That means that there's not a big issue here, and they also haven't demonstrate the substantive deprivation of privacy that's so important about peeing in a cup. So at that point, I think the real government obligation is to house people in need. We don't think this is coercive. We think it's consistent with policy and is the best option.
Thank you very much. Call PMR. You know the caveats. 5 minutes, please.
Thank you very much. Everybody for an excellent round. The problem with our insular perspective on ABDA is that we never seem to, in good faith, for one moment, really imagine ourselves in the shoes of people in poor communities and understand how the underlying assumptions of policies that the government passes and we just flippantly talk about in these debate rounds actually affects people within those social groups and their relationships with the government, how they perceive the government, whether they trust the government, and whether they think the government has their interests in mind or are fundamentally out there to oppose them, screw them over, and not trust in the fact that they are citizens of everybody fucking else. So let's deal with the fungible funds thing right off the top, because I think that this is where they think they really get their clash. Like, guys, you know, there's lots of people out there, and some of them aren't getting this welfare money. We've given you three good responses to this. The first thing we've told you is that a need-based system is better. Yes, you have to prefer some people, you can't afford everybody, but what Shomik told you isn't just have a basic needs standard. What he said was have a standard under which the people with the most need have first access to housing, and people with less need have less access to that housing. They're like, how the hell could you ever determine that? I don't know their fucking net worth. Like, what is this question? Like, you can clearly to tell who are the people who actually need this the most, who are the people with these big families, other things like that, and you can base it on that. Whether or not you do drugs has nothing to do with whether you need housing. I think that is very clear. The second argument we gave with response to fungible funds is we told you about a race to the bottom. They really bastardized this point, though, and they're just like, yeah, guys, they're just going to move to San Francisco, and life is going to be peachy because San Francisco is going to provide them with all the welfare benefits they need. Okay, first of all, this isn't true because Shamik told you they're going to move to the neighboring state. Like, okay, maybe San Francisco is the neighboring state in some instance, but the point of the underlying point of the argument is they'll move to places with good policies, and then those places will eliminate those policies because they can't afford the influx of welfare people coming from other states in which they like are running from these bad policies. So you get more bad policies, more restrictive policies in place of the ones that were in those locations that were actually good and allowed some people to have access to housing. Now fewer people will have that because they can't afford it. The last response we gave you is whether or not there are fungible funds has nothing to do with whether this is constitutional. That is the first prong of argument we gave you, and ultimately they never gave you a standard for why the Constitution says anything about fungible funds and about whether or not you have a good reason to like engage in, not a good reason, but like whether or not you sort of like look at fungible funds when you're deciding if something is reasonable. I think we gave you a much better standard of reasonability in terms of the constitutional analysis. So I'm going to ask two questions. Firstly, is this constitutional? So look, you can forget for a moment every practical impact of this debate until you think they've won this point. Our contention is that they didn't even really try in good faith to win this argument, right? All they say is it's voluntary, so it's okay, or the funds are fungible, so it's okay. That isn't a constitutional argument because the Constitution doesn't speak on that issue whatsoever. Like, would they be okay, for instance? Ask yourself this question. Would they be okay, or would you be okay, with searching the homes of people who are on these housing vouchers in order to look for drugs? If you think that would be a constitutional violation, which I think every single person in this room does, then I think the consequence is to search something more intimately private to them for the exact same reason is not going to be constitutional. But then they tell us, guys, federal job testing is different, so like we automatically win this point. Federal job testing for drugs is not constitutional. We told you we do not support it. We think it does not, like they have to actually argue this from first principle rather than just say this is constitutional, we do this, therefore it's okay. I don't think they've ever really made an effort at that. So look, also we told you, and they're like, it's a free choice. No, it's not a free choice. It might be nominally a choice. We told you it's a coerced choice insofar as the option that you're being given, maybe it's not starvation, although to some extent it is because we told you you need a kitchen to like make food and stuff like that, but okay, and you need like an address to send welfare checks to. But, so even if you don't think though that that's the case, it's still a choice of have a roof over your head or be outside in the cold. They're like temporary housing. Yeah, the word temporary is attached there for a reason though. And like you still might not have a roof over your head or you have to pee in this cup. That is not a real choice. Only we have an actual constitutional standard. What is it? We made it very clear at the top. They never really provided any substantive challenge to it. Either you have probable cause for the individual searches that you're doing, or you alleviate some kind of societal harm to third parties by doing the test. They do neither of these two things. Why? Because we told you, first of all, they clearly don't have probable cause. And secondly, they don't alleviate this harm, they make it worse. Because these people are addicted, they ultimately need these drugs based on their own physiology, so they do other things to get drugs. All they tell you is, guys, welfare money often isn't enough, so they like resort to crimes anyway. It's a comparative debate though, and they resort to more crimes and create more societal harm and more potential for imprisonment and the money that gets spent on that on their side of the house. So the round is over, but I'll talk about some other stuff because I've still got time. So second question, how to improve people's lives? So look, first of all, I would say, let's live in a society where we don't think temporary housing is real fulfillment of the substantive right to actually have a roof over your head. I don't think they've ever given an argument about
that. Another argument? Any argument that temporary housing is insufficient is new.
Everyone will take that under consideration.
Yeah. Here's the other argument out of PNC they never responded to. You get less people in rehab when you create a sense of distrust between the government and these communities. The government suspects you automatically by being poor of doing drugs and then subjects you to a test which clearly violates your rights, and even if it doesn't, certainly feels like a violation of your rights. You feel marginalized, you feel like you don't matter, and all these different benefits are harms that we talked about in the PNC. The last thing I'm going to talk about, though, is how we get more welfare money on our side. So why is this the case? Because this is like literally their whole collapse. Four reasons. First of all, the race to the bottom thing. So when the next state senator, a state over, can say, we're going to get this influx of people, so let's have a more restrictive policy, I think that's the kind of rhetoric that's going to fuel this problem. Secondly, they can paint this policy as having worked by showing the low numbers of positive tests and saying that the druggies didn't show up. That's another piece of rhetoric they can use. There's less money spent on jail and the cost of crime, so more money to apportion to these welfare programs. And lastly, a government statement that poor people are drug addicts and the oppressive people in society suggesting that are correct is necessarily going to lead to the like a legitimization of that view. For all of these reasons, we're incredibly proud to propose.